Coming up on Fronteras, the Affordable Care Act aims to increase access to health care. But for those in the so-called affordability gap, insurance may still be out of reach.
So I looked on the exchange and I started looking to see what plan that I was going to get. But I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to pay this.
Fronteras looks at access to health care and medical debt in the first of a two-part series. It was 150 years ago that Mexico was invaded by the French and ruled by Maximilian. It was a time of betrayals, brutality, and war. But who was Maximilian?
He was very idiosyncratic. He was used to being treated with great pomp and circumstance in his home country of Austria. But he was also a dreamer, and he really felt that Mexico was going to be his new realm.
How Mexico struggled to defeat Maximilian shaped the nation's character even today. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Like it or not, the Affordable Care Act was designed in part to give more people access to health insurance. The act could solve a number of problems for low-income people: better access to care, better health outcomes, and a reduction of medical debt. However, there are huge gaps in the plan. In the first of a two-part series, Tristan Anton reports on some people who will continue to fall through the cracks, running the risk of not having care or running up huge medical bills.
Meet Carla Castaneda. She's 22, is a single mother, and recently went back to school. Her son is eligible for Medicaid, but she is not because she makes too much money and her job doesn't provide her with insurance. To get coverage, she turned to New Mexico's insurance marketplace.
So I looked on the exchange and I signed up and registered and everything, and then I started looking to see what plan that I was going to get, but I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to pay this.
Castaneda is a community health worker in Albuquerque.
If I was just a full-time student, of course, I'd probably be able to qualify for Medicaid, but at the same time, I wouldn't be getting any income. So, you know, I have to work, but I can't work that much, but I still work too much to qualify for Medicaid, so it's hard.
Castaneda falls into what's being called the affordability gap, the economic no man's land where you make too much to be eligible for Medicaid and too little to afford coverage on the exchange, even with a federal subsidy. Sarisha Manet is an attorney with the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty. She says for this population, choosing to pay the $95 tax penalty for not getting insurance next year may be a more affordable option. That's because even the cheapest plan may not improve access. Here's why.
So on the exchange, you could choose something called a bronze plan, which is the cheapest plan in the sense of monthly payments.
Those payments could range from $15 a month to $150, depending on income.
But with the bronze plan comes very high out-of-pocket costs. So these are the copays that you have to pay every time you go see a doctor, what you have to pay for prescription drugs, your deductible.
The upfront cost to see the doctor, even on the plan, makes it unaffordable. So with something like a bronze plan, you can pay a lot less monthly on your insurance premiums. But if you actually end up in the hospital, you could be dropping as much as $12,000 in out-of-pocket costs.
For a low-income family that's making $25,000 to $30,000 a year, that's an extraordinary amount of money to pay out-of-pocket, which means that a lot of people are going to be susceptible to still having medical debt.
Which isn't so different than now. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, currently 1 in 6 families in America have had problems paying their medical bills in the last 12 months, while 1 in 10 families have medical bills they couldn't pay at all. Data also show that families with incomes at or below 250% of the federal poverty level are more likely to experience burdens from medical debt. Families most likely to take a gamble on their health in order to avoid paying for a plan or a procedure. Mark Schiffman is with ACA International, an association of third-party collection agencies. He says the debt landscape is changing with the Affordable Care Act due to the types of policies available.
Some of those might include that the consumer pays the copay, the consumer pays an increasing part of the deductible, or that there are less items covered under the elective procedure. So there's certainly more of a burden falling to the consumer or the patient.
Schiffman says there's still a lot unknown as the law is still rolling out, but his association is concerned that some consumers may be adversely affected by the cost of their care.
So it's an increasingly difficult proposition for both the healthcare system, but also for consumers who haven't been used to this sort of practice in the past.
With an estimated 60,000 people in New Mexico alone that could fall into the affordability gap, lawmakers may be tasked with creating local systems and providers that can serve these populations who will choose to pay a cheaper tax penalty rather than buy health insurance, like Carla Castaneda, in Albuquerque.
I just can't afford it. I can't afford to get sick. I can't afford to have an emergency. And that's how basically I'm looking at it right now, you know. Just don't get into trouble. I don't know. Don't get into an accident or something so that I won't have to have medical debt.
The fine for not having insurance begins at $95 next year. By 2016, the fine will increase to almost $700 per adult. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Autone.
This week, a national scholarship program was launched targeting undocumented immigrant students referred to as Dreamers. 12 American universities are taking part, including the University of Texas at El Paso. But the number is expected to quickly grow. Reporter Hadass Gold covered the story for Politico and joins us now with more.
This fund is called the Dream.us, and it was founded by the former CEO of the Washington Post, Don Graham, along with the former Secretary of Commerce, Carlos Gutierrez, and Democratic National Committee Finance Chairman Henry Munoz. And they have raised $25 million for this college scholarship that will give out 1,000 full tuition scholarships in the next academic year. And it's for, like you said, kids in the U.S. who are under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals under the Obama administration program. But these students are not usually eligible for in-state tuition or for scholarships or for the federal Pell grants, for example. So this, the founders say, will give them the support that they need.
Well, Republicans and Democrats have been wrangling over immigration reform. It appears this is bipartisan.
Yeah, they have a lot of people who signed up for it. Grover Norquist was at the launch event this week at the museum in Washington, D.C. Carlos Gutierrez is Commerce Secretary under George W. Bush. And in an interview we had with Don Graham, he said that he's only heard support from both Republicans and Democrats on the Hill and elsewhere because the scholarship fund, most people see it as a good thing, especially because this doesn't really touch upon the politics of immigration. It's just trying to get kids to go to college.
And what has been the trouble in getting some of these students to college? It's finding the funds. You mentioned they're not eligible for typical avenues of student aid.
Right. So if you're a Dreamer in the United States, you're not eligible for in-state tuition at a university. You might be allowed to attend, but you have to pay out-of-state tuition, which can raise your tuition from, let's say, $10,000 a year to $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year. The average, you know, even a well-off middle-class family can't really afford 4 years of tuition at that level. And normally they're able to find support from these federal Pell grants, you know, very low-interest loans, student loans, or scholarships. But as a Dreamer, you are not eligible for any of that. So your options are either pay out-of-pocket, you know, up to $70,000, $80,000, over the course of 4 years, or you're kind of stuck. So as a result, a lot of these students who might have done very well in high school and are, you know, have good transcripts and can go to college are not able to go. And so Don Graham says that this new fund is aiming to fix that hole that they've seen and help these students go until hopefully one day they say immigration reform will be passed. But they don't seem to think that that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, $25 million is a good chunk, but is there any chance that immigration reform could just make undocumented students under DACA eligible for federal grants and Pell grants like everyone else?
It is possible that if, you know, immigration reform is passed and includes a path to citizenship or a path to, you know, at least some kind of formal acknowledgement, you know, of residency or something like that, then they would potentially be eligible under Title IV for in-state tuition and for scholarships and grants that any other citizen of the United States is eligible for. But until that happens, which, as we've seen, immigration reform is a huge issue on Capitol Hill, you know, the Republicans have their own mindset. They want to do it in pieces, and Democrats are trying to, they want more comprehensive reform. And so it's a big issue that is going to play out over the course of the year, but it's unlikely that the student graduating this May or June from high school is going to benefit from that for a few years from now.
And the people you spoke to, what were they saying they're hoping the impacts of this fund will be?
They're really hoping to target not the students who are going to go, you know, to Harvard or Yale, because they say that those students, those schools already have enough money. They have billions of dollars in endowments to help pay for those students to go to school. They're focusing on the kids who want to be nurses. They're focusing on the kids who want to be accountants, who want to go to public schools, who want to go to community college, because they say those students are the ones that really don't have access. They might be smart and they might have all the tools they need, but they just don't have the funds. and they're stuck because even if they're eligible for scholarships or grants in terms of their grades and, you know, and their transcripts, they are not eligible for them legally. And so this is hoping to cover the cost of a community college or a in-state university tuition. So, you know, $25,000 isn't going to cover you going to, you know, Stanford for 4 years. But it will probably help you a lot going to community college, which is why they're saying that this is what they're aiming at.
All right. Hadass Gold, media reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. It was 150 years ago that Mexico was invaded by the French and ruled by Maximilian. It was a time of betrayals, brutality, and war. But who was Maximilian?
He was also a dreamer, and he really felt that Mexico was going to be his new realm.
How Mexico struggled to defeat Maximilian shapes the nation's character even today. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. It was 150 years ago that Mexico was once again invaded and occupied by a foreign power. This time it was the French, lured by what they thought would be the rich plunder of a poor nation. Maximilian was installed as the Emperor of Mexico, and while Mexico's elite rallied around their new ruler, the rest of Mexico fought back and drove the French out. It's history that reads like a novel, filled with bigger-than-life characters, betrayals, and twists of fate. And it's told in the new book, Maximilian and Carlota, Europe's Last Empire in Mexico. Mary Margaret McGowan is the author. She spoke with TPR's David Martin Davies.
Maximilian was an Austrian prince, the brother of the Emperor of Austria, and Carlota was the Princess of Belgium. Her father was Leopold I. During our Civil War, France decided that Mexico was ripe for the picking, and he, after much ado and much war in Mexico, he dispatched Maximilian and Carlota to rule Mexico.
Now, Mexico at the time, looking at the context of where Mexico was in history, not that long after United States occupation, 20 years afterwards.
Right.
And so at that time, you know, Mexico was virtually a failed state.
Right.
And so Mexico, not very strong. And then they had eventually elected Benito Juarez as president. He came in as an interim president, but then became the elected president. So what was it that Benito Juarez did to Mexico that helped usher in the invasion of an occupation of France and the installation of Maximilian?
Basically, Mexico had had for the previous 40 years 54 administrations under their status as a republic. The monarchists who still existed in the country felt that Mexico had become a failed state, and Benito Juarez and the other men who had risen from Oaxaca to run Mexico, they basically lost confidence in them and rallied the courts of Europe to bring back a monarchy to Mexico.
So Mexico was still dealing with many of the after effects of being a province of Spain. We still had a very much entrenched upper class that controlled much of the property of Mexico and the Catholic Church, which also controlled a lot of the wealth of Mexico. And Benito Juarez, who wanted to do some reforms that ran afoul of these people. And what role did this opposition play in bringing in Maximilian?
Well, the Catholic Church was the largest landholder in Mexico. And during the reform, Benito Juarez effectively seized most of their lands and began to sell them off to create a treasury for Mexico, which at the time had only revenues through the customs house and exports. And in doing so, he made an enemy of the Catholic Church, as well as the very devout monarchists. So that exacerbated the call for a renewal of a monarchy. They expected Maximilian would return those lands to the church, which in fact he never did. And so that also became problematic for Maximilian, having the Republicans against him and the Catholic Church.
Maximilian is actually a very fascinating character, full of contradictions, and someone who would frequently spoil expectations of what he would do. So can you talk about who Maximilian was as an individual?
He was very idiosyncratic. He was used to being treated with great pomp and circumstance in his home country of Austria. But he was also a dreamer, and he really felt that Mexico was going to be his new realm. He would do things, though, however, to work against himself. He would, while the French army was going throughout Mexico to defeat the Republicans, he would then confer absolution or liberty on the very people that the French were putting in jail. So he would do things that worked against him. When he came in, he put on his cabinet, instead of conservatives, he put liberal Republicans on his cabinet, which made the monarchists very angry. So he tried to reach out across party lines, not really knowing effectively how Mexico worked. He dreamt that he could bring all the people together. In fact, he invited Benito Juarez to be on his cabinet. And, of course, Maximilian, not totally understanding that Juarez very much intended to get his position as president back, he made enemies across the lines in that manner.
He's also somewhat of a progressive at the time. He wanted to rule as a monarch, but with a democratically elected legislative body.
Right.
He also wanted to forgive debts for the campesinos of more than 10 pesos. He wanted to continue to improve the conditions for the poor in the country. This is not what many of the people who installed him and invited him to come rule had expected. So it was very difficult.
It was, in that he was brought to the country by Napoleon III, but also by the Catholic Church and the monarchist party. And what happened is that he worked against the ways they wanted him to rule, but they all had their own agendas. The Catholic Church was horrified when Maximilian said, the first thing we must do is get the churches out of the schools in Mexico. The churches are the church and the state is the state. And he also allowed for liberality of worship, inviting all religions to worship. And that also horrified the Archbishop of Mexico, La Bastida, who had enjoyed being at the apex of power in Mexico as the head of the church, the only church.
Where did Maximilian and Carlota reside? Where do they live in Mexico City?
Maximilian and Carlota lived at first in the National Palace, but decided that it was too noisy and too much business going on, and they wanted to live somewhat in the country, which at the time was Chapultepec Castle, which they spent, by today's dollars, millions to restore. When Carlota was traveling, she was sent at one point to Yucatan by Maximilian to tour. He bought a place in Cuernavaca, where it was just a retiro, as they called it, a place to go and rest. And they spent their time very much between Mexico City and Cuernavaca.
A lot of people have been very fascinated by the romance between Maximilian and Carlota. Is that just fantasy, or is that really part of the historic narrative?
Well, Maximilian clearly loved Carlota. I think more than anything, they had what became more of a business partnership. The marriage was somewhat arranged by Leopold, but they were very much in love. But I think the stress and the strain of moving to another place and having failed at their own rule in Italy and then moving to Mexico, I think more than anything, she became his guide. And while they loved each other very much, he had romances on the side, and some asserted that maybe she did as well. But they clearly loved each other. They, in their letters to one another, they're quite romantic, and they depended very much on each other.
So what's the legacy of the French invasion and occupation of Mexico and the legacy of Maximilian today? It seems frequently glossed over as we think about the history of Mexico, but this is quite a dramatic episode. So how do we bring that to light?
Well, it's interesting. Even in Mexico, the people don't realize very much about this history because so much is talked about Benito Juarez. And it was a five-year period where he was uprooted, and it took him a while to get back into office. And no doubt he was a very charismatic man. what I think the legacy of the French, besides the food and the cultural influences that the French left on Mexico, as well as the Austrians and Belgians and what have you, I think what it said more about Mexico was that it wanted to be a republic. The people decided they wanted no more European intervention. They were not ripe for the picking. Their natural resources were important to them, and it was important to have the freedoms of a republic. And the Americans helped reassert that in a very powerful, meaningful way.
So you see in Mexico this talk of sovereignty and the importance of sovereignty and being willing to fight for that. It just seems like this is that story.
It's yet another example of the very complicated relationship that America, that the United States has with Mexico. It's an interdependency, yet Mexico and the United States very much want their independence, but they have a mutual need. It's a very complicated situation, but very much at the end of the Civil War, Andrew Johnson and Secretary of State William Seward felt that they must assert their power over Mexico as a protector of Republican values and as a mutually interdependent state with the United States. And in fact, Philip Sheridan said, and we say it says so, I repeat this in the book, that the Civil War would never fully be over until the French were out of Mexico. So they decided to then take their surplus arms and provide them, and as well as manpower, to the Republican Army of Mexico.
Mary Margaret McCallan is the author of Maximilian and Carlotta, Europe's Last Empire in Mexico, published by Trinity University Press. Her other books include I Would Rather Sleep in Texas, A History of the Lower Rio Grande Valley and the People of the Santa Anita Land Grant, and A Brave Boy and a Good Soldier, John C.C. Hill and the Texas Expedition to Mier. McCallan will have a reading and a book signing at the Twig Bookstore in San Antonio Saturday, February 8th from 4 to 6. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KNAU Flagstaff, KRWG Las Cruces, KNPR Las Vegas, KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KUAZ Tucson, KXWT West Texas Public Radio, KRTS Marfa, and KSTX San Antonio. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.